Hey guys, it's James Chester here. You're listening to the Gather Round the Lamp podcast by underagaslitlamp.com.
Gather Round the Lamp, an Aston Villa podcast.
Aimed in towards Archer! That's a fabulous header!
Once again, the Tigers banish the flick on. Oh, brilliantly done! Magnificent from Danny Ings!
He's going to have to go on his own here. He's perfectly happy to do this! Sensational goal!
Ramsey!
That's a big clap, mate. So,
gather round, villains, and welcome back to Gather Round the Lamp, an Aston Villa podcast brought to you by underagaslitlamp.com. It's still definitely on as Villa upset the Anfield apple cart and take the Conference League qualification to the final day. So we'll be looking back at a creditable point on Merseyside and look ahead to the vital decider this Sunday against Brighton. I'm your host, Andy, and today it's a warm welcome back to Dan. How are you doing, Dan?
I'm good, thanks, mate. Good to see you. It's been a few weeks, but how good is this? One more game to go in the season and we have something to play for that's not relegation. It's brilliant.
I know, it's incredible, isn't it? Yeah, it's not something we've been used to. What was it? They talk, say, 2010, 2011,
yeah, it was,
perhaps,
yeah.
was the last time we were in the European hunt, and that was a very different kind of thing. It was kind of we were going after the dregs at the time, having failed to qualify for the Champions League, but this is very different. This feels like another step in the right direction, doesn't it? So, we'll talk about it later, but, I mean, it will be an incredible atmosphere, I think, at Villa Park this Sunday.
Oh, I imagine so. I can't believe it's been 12 years, though. I kind of probably didn't have any grey hair then, probably didn't creak as much when I stood up either. So hopefully we'll make more of a habit of it now and not leave it another decade or so before we challenge for something at the end of the season.
Yeah, it's the days when I could still get into an extra large football shirt. It's a long way off, a long way off at the moment. But yeah, as I say, it was the difficult, really difficult trip to Anfield. Liverpool on a run of, I think, 7 or 8 unbeaten, or winning run. Only lost one at home all season. It was a bold team selection as well. Matty Cash, Luca Dean coming in for Young and Moreno at fullback. And Boubacar Kamara was back in as well, replacing Emi Buendia in the starting lineup. Leon Bailey kept his place. We sort of thought that might be the case in last week's show. Another injury, hopefully nothing too serious for Diego Carlos as well, kept him out. And of course, Moreno ended up getting injured quite soon after coming on in the game as well, and probably will miss next week. As I say, it was a really bold change to the back four. What do you think was the thinking behind that, and particularly sort of Cash and Dean coming in as fullbacks for this one?
I mean, it made sense, actually. I think much as I love Ashley Young this year, you don't particularly want him up against those flying Liverpool wide players, do you? He doesn't necessarily have the legs there anymore, whereas we know Matty Cash actually has a little bit of a turn of pace about him. So that makes sense to me. The Luca Dino one, I guess, he's slightly better defensively than Moreno. We love Moreno going forwards, but he's not as good at the defensive side. And fair enough, you imagine you'll be on the back foot a bit at Anfield. But, I mean, it's not exactly like he's a solid defensive left back. It's like saying your Morris Minor's a bit sexier than your Mini. It's not the best of upgrades, but still, it's a wise choice when you're... We knew we'd be under the cosh at Anfield, so it makes sense to kind of have that slightly more defensive player there. But wouldn't surprise me, not to get too distracted here, it's a little bit of the sign of thinking we might expect next year when we've got a deeper squad. We might have certain players for certain occasions, and slightly more defensive fullbacks would make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I do find it astonishing, really, that Luca Dean is seen as the steady Eddie at the back. I have mentioned this before, but we've kind of gone, if you think about the evolution of that position over the last few years, we started with Jordan Amavi, who couldn't defend. Then we brought in Neil Taylor, who could only defend. Matt Target was a bit of both, and you know, was a bit more attacking. And Luca Dean was seen as a bit of a maverick signing as a, as a fullback, because we were all very concerned about his defensive qualities. But now he's seen as the safe option back there at fullback. It's he just, you know, it's just different players for different games, like you say.
Similar on the right too, if you think about it, kind of going Hutton, Bree, kind of Elmo, kind of eventually landing on Matty Cash, who's a good attacking fullback who's got a lot better defensively. It's such an important position these days, fullback, isn't it? It's the most important position on the pitch, it seems. And I think we've done well, actually, to get two good fullbacks in. Well, more than two good fullbacks in the squad. We've got four decent fullbacks, and I think it's probably the only position we've got any strength in the squad. So why not juggle them around when you know you're going to be up against it?
Yeah, I think you're right about Ashley Young as well. I think possibly, you know, he might have been a bit caught out. But do you know what, with Ashley Young, we were talking about him a couple of weeks ago, because I voted for him as my player of the year, which was a sentimental vote, I think. I think probably Tyrone Mings or Douglas Luiz probably do deserve that award. But I voted for Ashley Young, and it's just, he keeps surprising me. Whatever challenge is put in front of him, he seems to rise to it. And if you'd have told me when Dean Smith signed him, which seems like 10 years ago in itself, doesn't it? If you'd have told me that he would, you know, play the majority of the season at right back this season, I wouldn't have believed you. So it's he's done incredibly well. He just needed a break. I think they have ways of knowing where players are in terms of their stamina and you know whether they're in that red zone and perhaps need taken out. And he's probably been in the red zone for about 8 weeks, to be fair to him.
Yeah, and I mean, you're right about Ashley Young. I think the best thing you can say about him is that you want him to sign on for another year, don't you? Which is a player at his stage of his career is all of the praise that you can perhaps give. But I mean, on the subject of player of the season, it would be Mings or McGinn for me, just because of the story arc that they've been on, from utterly dropped, me and the fan base as a whole kind of discarding them and looking to move on, and then coming back and being as vital as they've been. But that's the story of Villa's season. We've been down and now we're on the way up again.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, the Mings, it's frightening, really. You know, we could have ended up without him. He could have been sold. Gerard could have easily have moved him along, and thank goodness he didn't, really. And I wonder if the Carlos injury sort of played a part in that. Once Carlos was injured, they couldn't afford to let Mings go, maybe. Who knows what was going on, but it was certainly a bad situation anyway at the start of the season there. And another player who was discarded at the start of the season was Ollie Watkins, of course. And he's going through a rough time, isn't he, Dan? Really, he's on a bit of a goal drought. He does have this kind of feast and famine tendency, a little bit like the man who signed him, Dean Smith. Really, that kind of very very streaky at times. And we kind of thought he'd left that behind, but he's going through a bit of a tricky spell. And of course, he won this penalty. It was after about 20 minutes of the game, I think. Villa had made a really good start, getting on the front foot, controlling the play, and it was a great move, excellent passing by John McGinn, sort of round the side to Watkins, who got there first, and Konate clearly brought him down, only for Ollie to put the penalty wide. It was a shocking penalty, really. I mean, what do you think about Ollie? There's a story today that he's likely to be back in the England squad when it's announced this week. I'd say there's probably room for Mings and Ramsey in there possibly as well. But do you think he's just going through another little blip, or do you think this is maybe the sort of consequence of maybe being a bit more of a marked man in the Premier League these days?
It's hard to say, because as you say, he's so streaky, and he always has been at Villa. And to get it out of the way, he shouldn't be taking penalties for us. I love Ollie. He's got so many tools. He's never been a good penalty taker. I think that's four or five in his last nine that he's now missed, which is is unacceptable. And but penalty taking's an art form, and it's no shame to not be good at it. And fair play, he's a confident lad and he stepped up. But I think there is an element, though, that he's a marked man. We're a club with very few threats going forwards. Like the goals outside of Ollie Watkins and now Ramsey stepping up a little bit, there's not an obvious threat of where the goals are going to come from. So if you imagine your Jurgen Klopp lining up against Villa, you kind of tell the defenders, just mark Watkins out the game and strong chance Villa don't score. And we've been finding a way by hook or by crook over recent weeks. But I think that's where we really lack another threat. If we had another attacking player of Watkins' calibre or better, then it makes the opposition think twice about it, doesn't it? You can't double up on Ollie because you leave someone else free. And if you mark the other guy out the game, then Ollie pops up and gets a chance. And I think it just speaks volumes of where we're at in our trajectory under Emery, is once he's got a few more goal threats in that team, a few more exciting attacking players who aren't Leon Bailey, for example, then we might see Ollie getting the goals again. And it happens with all strikers, right? Like you go on a crazy run, everyone's talking about it, you get marked out the next few games. But he's back in that kind of funk where he is a little bit. But I'd say the one thing that I think is different this time with Ollie is he's still getting in those positions. The run to win the penalty was fantastic. Like, you can't fault his all-round play again, and he's still cropping up in those positions to score the goals. It's just not happening for him at the moment, but I think it will do again.
Yeah, and do you think he will be in that England squad this week? Do you think he'll get the call?
I hope he will be. I mean, it's I don't know what else he has to do if he doesn't get the call. But, I mean, it would be ridiculous, frankly ridiculous, especially you've got the Rashford injury kicking around at the moment, maybe makes Southgate's decision easier. But it would be utter madness if he didn't get the call up.
Yeah, he just seems to run into a kind of barren streak just before the squads, doesn't he? Obviously, before the World Cup, he wasn't scoring goals. And obviously Wilson was banging them in. Then Wilson goes through a bit of a barren spell himself. Watkins picks up, but there's no squad, so he doesn't quite get in the side. Or Tony gets in, and it's all he never kind of times his run right, does he, Ollie Watkins, when it comes to these squads? But I mean he's surely got a chance to be in, and I think really Southgate will do well to try and use this squad to bring in a few, that have been that are going to want to take the opportunity as well. You know, after a long season where there's been a World Cup as well, mm-hmm. you'd think he would bring players in that are hungry for it. You know, not players that are kind of thinking, oh my God, another two England games in June. So I think Watkins and a few youngsters, I think it's worth thinking about, really. But he'll want to put that penalty miss behind him next week, and it'll be the right game to do it.
Who would you have on penalties? Because obviously, I think we had a similar thing under that season with Dino, and then Jack ended up stepping up for penalty duties. But who would you have out the current lot on penalties, if not Ollie?
It's really difficult, isn't it? I mean, I've heard people talking about it this week. I mean, see, we had Danny Ings, didn't we? But he wasn't always on the field. I think I don't know. I'd be looking at, I suppose, Douglas Luiz or John McGinn.
Yeah,
you know. I think it'd have to be one of those two, wouldn't it? But even with those two, I wouldn't be confident.
No, not at all.
I wouldn't. Certainly, I think Douglas Luiz would overthink it, and John McGinn would be the opposite,
and he'd
probably just blaze it over the bar.
I think you're right, though. So, they're the only ones that stand out. And I wonder if it maybe affects the transfer dealings. Not that you buy a player because they can take a penalty, but it's one of those things to look at. Similarly to how we've almost lacked a set piece taker until Dougie's emerged. But I wonder if we're looking at a striker or a midfielder, maybe we start looking at whether they're comfortable with the ball in the penalty spot as well. Because, I mean, it can make or break games. I mean, we slot that penalty again away and Ramsey goes on to score as he did, and maybe it's a very different result this weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. It's I think when you miss a penalty as well, it gives the opposition a bit of a lift, doesn't it? And you know, they feel like they've got away with one, and it sort of focuses the mind. It didn't seem to on this occasion, well, though.
No.
Dan, Villa went kind of from strength to strength, really, and sort of piled on the pressure. I think Douglas Luiz was hugely instrumental in this goal, obviously. I mean, he set the goal up with an excellent cross, but also kind of won a couple of headers just to keep the ball in the Liverpool sort of final third. And the ball eventually broke to him just outside the penalty area. And he's whipped a lovely ball to the back post, and Jacob Ramsey has come in, and it's a really good finish. Mm. I think it looks a lot easier than it is. But to take that on his instep like that, and from such a tight angle on the volley, it's a really tough one. I bet there was a bit of spin on that ball as well from Dougie, wasn't there? So he's done really well, Ramsey, to slot that away. And there's so much to admire about the goal generally, and people have compared it to the Trezeguet goal in the semi-final of the League Cup a couple of years ago with the cross from Elmo. Very similar sort of goal, really. But yeah, I mean, for me, it just had that relentless quality about it, that kind of almost an Emery sort of trademark, you know, just keep the ball going forward, keep the pressure on. You know, and then that bit of quality to finish it off as well.
Yeah, and I suppose like Ramsey epitomises that under Emery, doesn't he? I saw a stat the other day, he's kind of third in the team for interceptions or something since Emery came in, and you see him kind of doggedly flying in there in the midfield. You see him breaking the ball forwards at pace, and you see him with lovely finishes too. He's scored a few goals this season that are just such crisp finishes. To use the horrible cliche, he almost hits them too well sometimes. Like he's such a sweet striker of the ball, and he has come a long way under Unai Emery. He's been a joy to watch, and I thought in this game particularly, he was running Liverpool absolutely. He was all over them. There was a lovely move. I can't remember if it was first or second half. The free kick as well, where he darted across the whole pitch and almost got in as well. And yeah. He's just a bundle of energy, which is one thing, but he's got the quality to go with it. And as you say, whether it's his finishing, which is superb, his running, which is good, and he's becoming a lot more tactically sound, I think, than we've ever thought he would be. And he just epitomises Emery's Villa, often similarly to John McGinn does on the other side, actually. They're both the players that I think are the calling cards of Emery's Villa this season. And look, he's homegrown. We all love to watch him. You see him walking the dog sometime. Like, he's everything you want in a star player. And I'm really excited to see where he goes next year, because he's another one of those players that I think did not enjoy life under Gerrard. He had that little spurt of goals under Gerrard, but he was another one we were wondering where his future lied. And Emery's turning him into a top-draw talent. And as you say, with an England squad coming up, I'd be checking my phone if I was Jacob Ramsey, because you never know if Southgate might be dropping him a line.
Yeah, well, he's certainly starting to add to his numbers at the right time, isn't he? He's having a really strong finish to the season. I just wonder with Ramsey as well. I mean, great goal, and everything you said is right. Has he got a bit of a streak about him as well?
Mm.
Because that celebration in front of the cop, not many 20-year-olds.
Yeah.
Do that, do they? And he's obviously very confident, but that was a bit of, you know, really trying to sort of rile the crowd up, wasn't it? And you know, I've not seen that side of him before. I think he's got a bit of an edge on the field. I think he's a lot tougher than people give him credit for. But that was interesting, because that looked really kind of almost. Like Steven Gerrard, how Steven Gerrard would be towards the Everton fans or the Man United fans, wasn't it? It was really kind of in your face stuff.
I think as a team, we've got that through us, though. It's been a kind of quiet thing since Emery came in. Is we're kind of nasty. We were again in this game. There was plenty of dark arts going on, and Tyrone Mings did his best to cave in Cody Gakpo's midriff, and it was. as a team, we've become not nice to play against without ever really going over the edge. And I mean, look, it's a contact sport, isn't it? You need that physical edge and that hunger and that fire about you. The team we were playing against at their best had that physicality and that edge to them as well. So I'm glad to see it in Jacob Ramsey. And as you say, for such a young lad, and I keep forgetting how young he is because he just looks like he's been there for years when he's on the pitch, to be that confident and say to give it the big one at Anfield, fair play to him. And I'd say just so excited to see where he goes next year, because this is 6 months of Emery working with him and probably 2-hour video sessions and things like that, which, by the way, I read a great thing in my spin in The Athletic this week that the players have to not drink too much water before the video sessions because they don't have to ask to go to the loo like a naughty schoolboy. But yeah, he seems to be taking everything on board and he's becoming such a good player to watch. Like, he really is. It's fantastic to watch. And yeah, the fact he's homegrown as well, it just fills you with hope that we might see, well, maybe him and his brother have kind of starting for us next year and really showing the way forward to the rest of the team.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see with his brother, you know, what happens with him. I imagine he'll have another year out on loan in the Championship, because he's obviously done really well at Borough the end of this season. But it'd be interesting to see how he develops as well. But Ramsey, he is going on to another level. I think he did last year as well. He stepped up a level, had a bit of a dodgy end to the season and went missing a bit at the start of this season, but he's really come good. You know, I think since the Everton game, I think that was a bit of a turning point for him, really. And since then, he's been excellent. And he is such a goal threat from that position. He's really, really dangerous. And he's one I don't think that other teams are picking up on, really. I don't think they're really alive to it at the moment. But yeah, I do wonder whether that celebration was a bit of a nod to Gerrard, a bit of a dig back. Because Gerrard definitely did a very similar celebration years ago in front of the Everton fans when he scored, and I wonder whether he's just having a little pop there at his old boss.
Oh, maybe. I mean, fitting well. Apparently, the Villa fans were giving plenty of Gerrard stick as the game wore on as well. I heard a little bit of that kicking around. So yeah, maybe he did pick up on it. But fair play to him. Like, score a goal like that, celebrate however you want, lad.
No, you're absolutely right, and I think that's the. Yeah, obviously great goal, and it set up a really good sort of interesting second half, really, didn't it? With we knew, I think, that Liverpool were gonna come and have a real go, obviously, and try and get back into the game and try and win the game, because they had to win the game really to pile the pressure on for fourth place. Just on the Tyrone Mings incident, obviously he's. You know, there has been a lot of discussion about whether it should have been a red card. He has gone in quite high. He's won the ball, and he's raked his blades down Gakpo's stomach. You know, so you know, it looked quite nasty. It looked quite painful. He'll be getting the Savlon on that. I dare say, on that wound. I mean, what did you think? I mean, you know, sort of listening to the commentary without seeing it actually on the day, I was expecting him to have almost done a Cantona kung fu kick into him from the way it was described on Sky. What did you make of it?
It's a tricky one, because I think it's compounded by the odd offside decision as well later in the game. And I think the only way I can probably react to it is if they'd have gone against Villa, we'd have probably been talking about them quite angrily on this podcast today. But the other thing that you've got kind of there, which I never like saying, but we know Mings isn't really that kind of a player. It did strike me as well. I didn't watch the game live, and so when it came to the highlights, I was looking out for it, and it just looked like a mistake more than something dangerous. But it's always nasty when the player takes his top off and shows his wounds to the referee. You know, it's not been a good tackle. And I mean, especially in this age of VAR where you slow everything down to minute frames, I was surprised Mings didn't get his marching orders. But it's we've said a million times, we've had so many decisions go against us, it's hard to begrudge one or two going our way. It's just, I think, I probably feel for Liverpool fans that that we had two or three go our way in the same match.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I was expecting kind of to see him, you know, sort of obviously high kick, you know, and sort of leading and following through a little bit. But he looked like he'd kind of tried to get his leg away as well at the end. I think the issue is kind of with Mings is he does have a little bit of form, doesn't he? He's not the sort of bloke that you'd expect to go out to hurt somebody. But he has inadvertently stamped on a couple of players' heads, hasn't he, in his career. You know, and I say inadvertently, you know, I'm absolutely certain it was. But I wonder whether that sticks in people's minds a little bit. He's got a bit of form for that sort of thing. And, you know, whether that's kind of... Because there's no doubt about it, certainly wasn't as bad as Jota's one against Spurs the other week. No. And I think Haaland's had one that was a lot worse as well, where he's kicked someone in the head. It's easier for Haaland to do, I think. it wasn't a red for me. And if the benchmark is Jota not getting sent off against Spurs, then certainly Mings didn't deserve to get sent off either.
Yeah, and I'd probably agree with you there. And I think the other thing that probably doesn't go in Mings' favour is he can be an ungainly defender sometimes. We're used to seeing him on the ball and he's smooth and pretty controlled, but he can be all limbs sometimes when he's defending. And he has a habit of kind of making decent challenges almost look like fouls because he's all arms and legs. He's a little bit like Peter Crouch when he used to play for England. Fouls would be given against him just because he looked weird going for the ball. And I get that same vibe from Tyrone sometimes. He's a big lad and his legs are huge, like proper gadget legs he's got on him. And I think sometimes refs kind of, you know, he gets a bad rap for that. But I mean, As I say, I can see it either way. I'd have been harshly done by had he had been sent off. And if I was a Liverpool fan, I'd feel like I'd been harshly done by that he wasn't sent off.
Yeah, definitely. And there was a lot of talk about the referee in this one, not least as well with the Gakpo goal that was disallowed for an offside. I mean, Liverpool had kind of started to try and throw the kitchen sink, although Villa were just defending resolutely, really, and not letting an awful lot go past. But Gakpo, there was a bit of a scramble in the area and the ball fell to Gakpo and he controlled it and put it in the net. But it was disallowed for an offside against Van Dijk. The ball sort of appeared to come off Konsa and there was some debate as to whether Konsa had tried to play the ball. If it's inadvertent, the player that it comes off the defender, then it kind of doesn't count. But if they try and play the ball, then it counts as, you know, as onside. You know, it's another phase sort of thing. So what did you think of this one? Did we get away with one a little bit here, do you think?
I think we got away with one. I mean, the rule is a mess the way it's written and there's so much interpretation involved. And when you slow it down, it does look like Konsa kind of flicks the outside of his boot at it. You know, we've all done it as a player. The ball's gone past you. You almost throw your leg up behind you in the hope of getting it. And the question is whether that's a deliberate attempt at intercepting the ball or just a reaction as a footballer. But I think that's where the law is an absolute mess. So trying to decide if it was intentional or not is nigh on impossible. So I think we got away with one for sure. And again, if it had happened against us, I'd have been livid because you slow it down, it does look like he swings a boot at it. But,
yeah,
you know, you make your own luck, as they say. And we did defend absolutely resolutely in this game. I was actually surprised we ended up conceding because it just felt, you know, watching Soccer Saturday at home, I was like, we're not going to concede. This is Emery's Villa now. We don't concede goals. Doesn't matter how good the opposition are. We don't concede goals anymore. So I think you make your own luck. And I think Konsa has had such a good season. He deserves the odd break here and there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you can't really tell that. And this is the problem with all these laws. They always, offside should be a definite thing, shouldn't it? Mm-hmm. But they seem to always throw in these little subjective caveats, which which complicate it and make it all about like things. I think when you're trying to judge a player's intent to do something, you know, you're on really shaky ground because it's different with something like that, but there's this, you know, whether there's intent for handball, whether there's intent for fouling a player, you know, I mean, it's a really, I think you're on really dodgy ground trying to judge those things because you can always find evidence to the contrary. And, you know, it looked like he tried to concert through a leg at the ball. I'll go with the referees.
We'll support the referees in this one.
Yeah, but I mean, obviously, Liverpool did get their equaliser. Roberto Firmino equalised on 90 minutes, a mere 10 minutes before the game finished. And there was a sense of surprise and annoyance, really, that Villa didn't allow Liverpool to have it all their own way for this one. All the talk is obviously of Liverpool challenging United and Newcastle for that Champions League place. But like you say, this is now sort of commonplace for the Villa defence and midfield. Midfield were absolutely excellent in this game, certainly controlled the first half. And Villa haven't conceded more than one since Arsenal beat us 4-2 on the 18th of February, which is an incredible statistic, really. And it's just a great foundation to build on. But I don't think either the media or other teams really give us that credit that we are actually doing this right. It's not just a good run of luck sort of thing.
Yeah, no, I fully agree with you. And we were actually chatting before we recorded why we aren't getting more praise, because the turnaround has been unbelievable since Emery came in. And even as you say, recent weeks, I made a little note here that we played Newcastle, Man U, Tottenham and Liverpool, and we took 7 points out of those four games. I mean, that's phenomenal. That's absolutely phenomenal. And it seems like it's flown under the radar. And I don't mind the national media not talking about us. I don't mind pundits not talking about us. It just feels slightly odd when we've got such a turnaround. We're playing such good football too. And we're going to places like Anfield and not just giving as good as we get, but going with a plan and then upsetting a team in fine form. And I just don't know why we're not getting more praise. But I think it's probably that the media and pundits thought we were doing okay under Gerrard. I don't know if they were watching games or watching the table, but there was this assumption that Gerrard was doing a half-decent job. And so they were almost shocked when we brought Emery in, and almost maybe they just think we've reverted to the norm. But you go back and look at it, we were 3 points above the drop when Emery came in, and now we're, 3 points off of Europe. And I don't think I've ever seen a turnaround in a team season or a turnaround just on sheer managerial quality ever in the league like this.
No, absolutely. And this is what kind of I was thinking about this earlier in the week. It isn't something that happens. Normally, a team like a top team will drop off a bit and they'll sack the manager and they'll appoint someone from a similar pool of managers, similar quality, similar standard. And they'll pick up again and they'll move forward and no one really notices. You know, likewise, a lower team will have a back manager that's obviously failing, but they won't necessarily have the ability to go and fetch someone out of a level or two above them, because you know of the situation and because of you know the finances or whatever it happens to be. But Villa have managed to go from someone who's a rookie essentially and a very poor coach to someone who's like a world-class elite coach, which never happens, does it? No, that's so rare. In I suppose you could argue like Lampard to Pochettino might be a bit like that, but you know Chelsea are just reverting to the norm there, aren't they? Whereas Villa have gone from a succession of fairly ordinary managers, some that have done really well, like Dean Smith, some that have been poor, to going to getting someone who's way above where Villa were at the time. It's it's quite incredible. It's real, and it's really stark, that difference. If you watch, if we went back now and watched the Bournemouth game or even the Everton game earlier in the season that we won, and now look at the performances now, it's just absolute night and day.
Oh yeah, and we were actually on the on our little WhatsApp group we've got, we were talking in the week about whether Gerrard is the worst manager Villa have perhaps had. And it just makes what Emery's done that much more incredible. It's almost like we had to handicap Emery because it would be unfair on the rest of the league. Like, he's been managing with one hand behind, like tied behind his back, or the rest of the league got a 3-month head start because it would be unfair otherwise. Like, he's taken over a team that had zero confidence, a squad that is paper thin with some dicey players in there too, if we're completely honest. And he's rocketing up the league with them. Like, I mean, watch out the rest of the league, because next year with an actual pre-season and his squad and not 3 months wasted under a mad vanity project, I mean, who knows where we'll be. But, I mean, the one thing I think we can all be sure is we're not going to be looking down the table again and worried about relegation. I think this is a real turning point for the club in our trajectory, and it's wonderful to have such a good manager. And I just feel at the moment just so trusting in everything Emery's doing at the club. I don't stress on a weekend match day. I'm not worried about the direction we're going in. There's no sleepless nights over who we're buying or what's going on. It just feels remarkably chilled to be a Villa fan at the moment. And I almost don't want the season to end because I'm enjoying it too much.
Yeah, I will just warn against that sense of security that you're putting out there, Dan. But at the end of the day, we still play at Villa Park and we still play in claret and blue. And, you know, we've had false dawns before. But I do tend to agree. I certainly think, you know, in years gone by, going to Anfield was just... And we've got a reasonable record at Anfield over the last 10 or 15 years. But... usually it's 3 points gone, isn't it? And I can't say that, you know, I would have been relatively humble going into Saturday, but I can't say that I was particularly surprised at how things went. And I'm almost more surprised that we ended up only drawing the game in
the
end.
Which is mad, isn't it? Like, that's utterly mad as a Villa fan. And I think the one thing I would say, I know what you mean, we've had false dawns before, but... You said it yourself, and I kind of highlighted it in your notes earlier. Like, this is the template for Villa now. This isn't a maverick winger who's grabbed a team by the scruff of its neck and is helping us win games. This is not a streak that we're on. This is a way of playing that is the Villa way already. And away from home, it's happy to be dirty and six at the back and backs against the wall if we need to. But also being incisive and getting the ball forwards and being brave on the ball. And this is the reason why this one feels different to me. And no doubt I'll be on this podcast in a year's time bemoaning our bad luck or something. But it feels sustainable because this is a way of playing that the manager's laying down. It's not a fluke. It's not a random result or a good performance. I don't think we played great at the weekend, and we're disappointed to not get a result at Anfield. And that speaks to the project, I think, and what the manager's instilled already. And clearly those long video sessions are working.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, said last week, you know, that... Certain methods might have a certain shelf life for players. Not every player is going to buy into it forever. We've seen it with other teams. Obviously, Bielsa at Leeds, Pochettino at Spurs. You know, you need to be able to refresh. You need to be able to let players go as well. And you know, when their race is run in this regard. Otherwise, you know. Things do sort of fall apart a little bit, but hopefully that's a little way in the future yet. And I'm sort of putting a bit of doom and gloom on the thing there, but no, it's a great run, it's a fantastic run, and it actually as well. I've put a little bit where I wanted to just mention the fact that obviously the headlines have been completely dominated by Jurgen Klopp complaining about time wasting, not enough injury time, bookings, all this sort of thing. You get nothing of that ever really from Emery. He just talks about the game. He's very polite, very honest. He's critical of his own players at times, but he never really goes after referees or talks about any, the other team or anything like that. He's very kind of just focused on what him and his team are doing. And I have to say that that's something that certainly Gerrard didn't have that level of humility. Klopp definitely hasn't. And I understand when managers are like that because they're under a lot of pressure, but it's just so refreshing, I think, to draw the game and you've got two managers behaving in totally different ways after the game.
He's a phenomenal manager because he has no ego about him. I mean, he must do, all managers do, but he never puts it on display. He's just quietly cool, quietly doing his own thing. And maybe, to your point earlier, maybe that's why he's not getting more praise in the media, because he doesn't covet it. He's not out there giving the sound bites, chasing the headlines, giving the interviews. He's just quietly going about his business. And I've got a huge amount of respect for the way he carries himself and the way he manages this team. And I like the fact he puts himself in the background, because it means he can get on with his job without getting into ridiculous arguments about refereeing decisions. He's just, you know, if we do something wrong, he looks at a way of fixing it, not someone to blame. And I didn't expect that from him as a manager. I expected we'd get this tactical genius. I expected we'd get someone who was maybe a bit camera shy. I didn't think we'd get someone who was such a nice character. I'd never seen that of him in his managerial career. And there's a little bit of what was good about Dean Smith in him, in that he's the kind of manager you kind of want to support. He's a good guy, and that's nothing to be ashamed of. And especially in a league where there's a lot of not very good guys, it makes me kind of proud to be a Villa fan again.
Yeah, and I think another nice thing is, you know, he obviously is really highly regarded in the game. Klopp spoke really highly of him. As you'd expect, I think. But also some of the sections of the media have come out and obviously condemned how he was treated at Arsenal, the ridiculous, you know, horrible xenophobia. Oh, yeah. And, you know, I'd love to know how many languages some of those fans or reporters speak, to be honest. But he has dealt with all that with massive kind of grace, hasn't he, really? And you know it's good that people are turning around and saying, you know, that was obviously wrong. There'll be some that don't, obviously, but you know, I think he's just great. He's just, and he's a massive selling point for the club. He's on all the season ticket promotion. Yeah. he's on all the VT. it's very much, they're pushing this idea that things are improving with this manager. And some interesting quotes attributed to the owners as well in the week regarding Matteo Alemanni turning the club down, going back to Barcelona, and some reports in Spain that Villa, you know, the financial situation put him off. It wasn't quite what he expected and all the rest of it. And the quotes from the owners, or attributed to the owners in the Spanish media, are very much, no, you wait till the summer and then judge us, sort of thing.
Yeah,
which is exciting.
It's an interesting one, that. I don't think our finances are as clear cut as we maybe think they are, just because Gerrard splashed the cash on some kind of vanity players. That said, I think we were always a stalking horse maybe in these negotiations. Barca are a basket case of a club as it is. And I think he kind of said he was walking to get that little bit of fan power behind him so he could make the moves he wanted to in the summer, not the moves maybe the Barca hierarchy wanted him to make. So I was excited about it, but it always felt a little bit like we were a stalking horse for him and a convenient one. And he just used us to get what he wanted there. But do you know what? I'd rather find that out before he joins. And I think no matter what happens, and you were mentioning to me before we came on, we're getting in people around who've worked with Emery before that he wants to work with. So as long as you say, he's got the keys to Villa Park at the moment. If he wants to bring in his own backroom staff, his own sporting director, his own international technical scouts or whatever the new job titles are, then let him hire who he wants.
Yeah, like you say, the club have announced today that they've appointed Alberto Benito and Pablo Rodriguez to work in the backroom, well, as part of the global technical structure, they call it, which I don't think is a department Villa have had previously, certainly not under Dr. Tony anyway. But there's obviously And that this is added to the appointment of Chris Heck,
mm-hmm.
Who is taking up a very senior role in the whole sort of structure, really. So it's, you know, they're building that kind of structure. Use that word again. They're building it up, aren't they? And making things very, very operational off the pitch. It doesn't fill me with huge excitement. I find it very difficult to get excited about Villa appointing a suit. You know, it's not something. But so long as they're doing the job they're meant to do behind the scenes, and we'll see. You know, these appointments are not for this summer or the next transfer window. These appointments, you see the things come to fruition, hopefully in 5-10 years time. You know, that's the idea. Nothing's, you know, they're not going to have a major impact as yet, you know. But it's all good sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Sort of building for the future.
And you're right, it's not sexy. It's hard as a fan to get excited. You'd much rather see a player being paraded around the pitch. But they are really important. We can see the issue with Southampton going down. Southampton for a long time were regarded as a well-run club. And it only takes one or two seasons, one or two bad appointments or decisions at any level of the club for that, for you to not be a well-run club anymore and for you to be bottom of the table and plummeting into the Championship. So these kind of appointments are really important because they keep the club not only ticking over, but attracting more income, finding better players, finding better staff, whatever it is. You've got to, you can never rest on your laurels in the Premier League. And we've seen that this season we'll probably be in a situation where all three promoted clubs stay up. Like the trapdoor is a very real threat. And you know every team below us is going to be pushing us like we're pushing the top six this year. So as well as on the pitch with the sign-ins and the coaching, you've got to off the pitch raise the game too. And, you know, a commercial director doesn't excite me, but if he raises revenues the right way, makes us a better business, then that all feeds into the club. And it can only be good. And I know you've talked about it on the pod a bit. It's a shame that some of those costs are being passed on to the fans at the moment. But it's ultimately, I think what we're doing off the pitch is as important, if not more important, than what we're doing on it. It's just not fun. Yeah, okay. That's it. You're right. It's not fun. It does not make for good podcasting.
No, and I'm happy to take your word for it and leave it there. But no, it's all good. Let's see how it goes over the next few years, and you know, we'll hopefully reap the rewards of that. But we've got to get on to Sunday, really, haven't we? And the big game, biggest game that Villa have had, certainly since the playoff final. Absolutely massive game at home to Brighton and Hove Albion, who, congratulations to them. They secured, or more or less secured, their Europa League place after beating relegated Southampton 3-1 on Sunday. It's absolutely deserved, this is. I can't stress this enough. I think, you know, obviously, the whole thing with football tribalism is you're not allowed to congratulate other teams, but in this case, you can't do anything other. They've gone from strength to strength under De Zerbi, after having their club pretty much ransacked by Chelsea for Graham Potter and his backroom team, and they've been absolutely tremendous to watch all season. Played some excellent football. I think they've got the highest XG over the season, and or one of them at least, scored lots of goals, which was always something that was levelled at them previously, that they didn't score. They played some good stuff, but they couldn't really score goals. It's just been an incredible season for them, and congratulations to them. And I'm sure their fans will have a great time in the Europa League.
Oh, you know they will next season. They're a club after my own heart. I'm from down that way, and I've had a season ticket at the Amex before. I've watched them when they were playing in a leisure centre car park, essentially, at one point. It was ridiculous. And to see the club kind of, you know, always had a soft spot for them as I grew up around that way. But it's an example of a well-run club again. They kind of, as you say, the backroom staff gutted. They seem to lose their biggest player every year, and they just keep coming back stronger and stronger. And I think you're right. The real high point of this year is they've just been fun to watch. And I think they're a good example for Villa to follow. But hopefully now they've run their race for the season. They've qualified for Europe. There's surely no need to try anymore. They can pack up and go sit on the beach somewhere.
Yeah, I'm hoping they put in one
one extra big shift on Wednesday night against Man City. And this might be going out after that game. They're playing City on Wednesday night, who have already won the league, obviously, with a massive asterisk alongside it. Hopefully it'll be a really tough game. I can't imagine it will be, but, you know, both teams have achieved what they wanted to already, haven't they? So, you know, but it might just take a little bit out of them, and they'll turn up to Villa Park, you know, a little bit, maybe with one flip-flop on.
It's a shame Sunday. They don't have the cup final, isn't it? If they'd have been in the FA Cup final, that would have been perfect for us, because you'd imagine they'd have rested half the squad. But I think by then they shouldn't have anything to play for, but that doesn't mean they're not a dangerous side. They seem to, at this final stage of the season, there's been no predicting them, has it? They've lost games you'd expect them to walk, and then they've gone on fresh teams you'd expect them to do badly against.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously Villa at home. It brings back memories of the season in the Championship when we stopped them winning the title and gave it to Newcastle with a very dodgy Jack Grealish deflected shot. We got a draw that day and took the title away from them. So maybe they've got a little bit of needle, and they'll want to do a similar thing to us, maybe, and stop us getting into Europe. But, you know, we'll obviously wait and see. It's going to be a huge atmosphere at Villa Park. There's all sorts planned. I think welcoming the coach before the game, streamers, balloons, all the rest of it. You know, and it's like you say, it's such a great thing to have a home game, last game of the season, with something major riding on it as well. You know, obviously that seventh place and qualification for the Conference League. It's all or nothing, and obviously we have to just better Spurs' result, hope Brentford slip up at Man City or against Man City. But it is a huge test, really. So can Emery get them over the line? Can we do it? Can the team sort of give us something tangible, you know, right at the end of the season?
The way I keep looking at it is it's a cup final, isn't it? It's a one-off game. You win, you're in, and we've got a cup final specialist as a manager who I imagine will really want this. Spend all week getting the players ready. Every detail will be looked at. And it's at home where we've been so good and the fans have been so important. So I'm feeling quietly confident. But as you said earlier, we're Villa fans, so you can never be too confident. I imagine you're pretty nervous already, Andy.
Yeah, nerves are building. I think it's a massive game. It feels not dissimilar to the sort of week before the playoff finals that we went to and that sort of thing. You know, it is something major. It's going to have a huge bearing on the direction of the club in the next couple of years, I think. So I think it's beyond our wildest dreams this season as well. You know, we'll obviously get, you know, the Mickey Mouse comments and things like that for desperately wanting the Conference League, but I don't really care. It's a huge sign of the progress that's been made. It doesn't have to be the end. It doesn't have to be the high point, you know. But if it is, you know, It's a season playing European football, which will be tremendous for everyone. So, yeah, really, really just looking forward to the game. Kind of want it to be over as well.
Well, that's it, isn't it? When you've got a big game, you almost want to fast forward to the end because you know it will be a struggle. But, I mean, I think earlier on in the season, I was joking about the Conference League and was a bit disparaging of it, but that's because I kind of thought we didn't have a chance of getting in, and now we're close. I've never been more interested in the competition. I think the theme tunes like leapt to the top of my Spotify playlist. I've just got it on repeat and hope it'll be Thursday nights. But I mean, look at West Ham this year. They've had an awful season, but they got to the final of the competition, and it clearly means a lot. And I'd love that to be Villa next year. I'd say 12 years is a long time to be without European football, and I'd really enjoy a European ride under Unai Emery. And almost, I mean, we were talking about kind of Jacob Ramsey's brother earlier, and we're kind of, those are the players that might, if we get in the Conference League, get a lot of valuable minutes to them. There's a lot of games in the Conference League, and there's a lot of midweek games where we could see youngsters play, we could see squad players play. So not just for us having kind of great nights under the floodlights, it's a really good development opportunity for a lot of our players too, and a really good chance to attract a separate caliber of players as well, because you're in European football, and we've got Unai Emery in charge, so you've already got one hand on the trophy too when it comes to a Europa League or kind of Conference League trophy. So it would be a huge achievement, and it would be so exciting to go into next year knowing we've got Thursday night football. I'd have to probably get a subscription to some ungodly service in order to watch it, but it would at least be worth watching.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? We do have the cup specialist. He is yet to win a cup match for Aston Villa.
That's true, yeah.
And all right, losing to Man United wasn't so bad, but the Stevenage one still gives me nightmares. But yeah, hopefully that'll improve next season. But you know, whether we're in Europe or not, you know, we can try and have a better tilt at a cup run, I would like to think. So,
do you remember when we lost to Stevenage at home? That feels like a lifetime ago, that Stevenage game. Like, it's a season it's been since then. It feels like that feels like a different season and a different manager almost.
Well, and at that point, you see, it could have gone either way. The season still could have gone either way. I think we'd come back and lost to Liverpool first game back after the World Cup, and we beat Spurs, and then we lost to Stevenage, I think. And you know, it was we were in a bit of a which way is this going to go, you know, and still a massive mistrust of the players and the squad, certainly on my part. I spoke about that quite a lot, but I think obviously they've gone on to another level, and over this period proved me and a lot of other people wrong about them. So it's great to see, but big one then. So prediction, Dan?
Oh, I almost don't want to. I don't want to jinx it in any way, but I do feel all we've got to do is better Spurs' result, right? I don't think Brentford are going to do anything against City. He says famous last words. So all we've got to do is better Spurs' result, which should be doable given the kind of burning clown card that they are at the moment. But I think a Villa win. I'm not sure what the score will be.
They are playing Leeds, though.
Oh, well, that's a good point. It's clown car versus clown car. Who knows what will happen? Yeah. But I think we'll win, but... And I hope we score early and it's a procession, but I think it might be a nervy one.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm going to go for basic 2-1 win. I think Brighton are obviously going to score, aren't they? We beat them 2-1 earlier in the season, didn't we? So, you know, I don't think many teams have done the double over them this season. So, you know, that might be quite a good thing. Quite a good little feather in our cap as well. So I'm going to go 2-1, I think. So we'll see. But to everyone who's going, have a great day. I'll be there, obviously. Thanks, Dan, for joining me today. It's been great to chat that really good performance over with you. It was a real kind of sort of, I don't know, a sort of performance that defines a season, I thought. You know, very, very, very good indeed. And thanks to everyone for listening. Obviously, enjoy the game on Sunday. Let's hope we get the result we want. And we're back here next week talking about looking ahead to a European campaign next season. In the meantime, obviously, if you want to set your notifications on, wherever you get your podcast, so you get a notification when the podcast is out, that'd be great. And give us a search on the social medias platforms, to follow all the news from underagaslitlamp.com. But until next week, stay safe, keep the faith, and up the Villa.